Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's December 2nd, 2011. You're listening to the best PokerCast on the planet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
I gotta tell you, you know, for the longest time, I've been searching for that television show Taxi. You remember that show from the 70s and I guess a little early 80s maybe?
Yes, I heard it's really good, and surprisingly, it's one of those shows that I've never seen.
That's kind of weird. You know, when I was younger, my parents started watching it, so I used to watch it all the time. And then it was in, like, syndication, and I watched it, like, just tons and tons of times because it was funny. Jimmy Natowski was hilarious, Louie. And I watched it a lot, and then for the longest time, I couldn't find it. It was on Nick at Night in the, like, 90s, and I was like, all right. So one night, I'm, like, stumbling through, I don't know, the non-HD channels, which I almost never do anymore. I just watch all HD. And there it is, Taxi's on. And I'm like, holy cow! So I get the DVR all programmed, they get a season pass, so I start watching these shows again. And one of the things that I always like to do when I'm watching TV shows or movies is two things. One, whenever, like, Florida comes up on a movie or a show that I liked when I was a kid in Connecticut, my ears always perk up because back then I never thought about Florida. But now, yeah, you know, I could literally hear something about, like, St. Pete or just know that someone's from that area. And I didn't know it because when I moved here, I didn't watch those shows again or those movies. So that stuff always interests me. I always like to hear that and get a giggle out of it. But then the other thing, too, is I always like to see poker when it comes on these shows that I hadn't, or movies or whatever, that I hadn't seen in a long time. And this gave me a whole new perspective of how just ignorant Hollywood is to poker, other than the whole rules thing. And it came up literally on, like, the first episode that I watched of Taxi again after a good 20-year hiatus. You know, Louie, you know, he's got his mom, and his mom lives with Louie, and you don't know this, so I'll give you a little backstory. And he has a brother, and the brother is a professional poker player who was only on one episode. They just wrote it to get this one guy on and or whatever. So, you know, he wasn't a recurring character or anything, but he was a professional poker player. So as soon as I heard that, I'm like, oh, man, I got to watch this. I'm going to see what happens, you know. So the brother comes to town. He's got the big, gaudy, fat white tie and the dark pink shirt with the black blazer over it. And he's got the, you know, the almost a pompadour haircut with the streaks of gray in it, you know, big rings on his hand, you know, typical, stereotypical thing.
Yeah, that's not stereotypical at all.
Yeah. So I'm like, all right, this should be good. So I figured it was just going to be one of those, I call and raise you and all that crap, which I was prepared for. I'm like, all right, it's Hollywood, you know, whatever. Anyway, it turns out that, you know, Louis hates his brother. Not hates him, but resents him because Louis stuck with the mother and he wants to, you know, he wants the brother to take her, and he lives in Vegas, the brother, and he, of course, that's where he plays poker and everything. So he's like, look, I want you to take mom, at least for a little while, you know, and he's like, and I want you to go visit her while you're in town. And while he's there talking to him in the garage at the Taxi place, the Christmas bonuses were given out to all the drivers, which, of course, you know, I don't even think drivers get bonuses, but they had to do it for the show somehow.
Like, I never got a bonus.
I know.
30 years in the real workforce.
So, exactly. So, but you know, just to make it, you know, a more plausible story, they give everybody a ton of money. And one of the things they always do is while they're waiting for their cab to be called, they used to always sit around this, you know, 2x4 table and play cards. But they wouldn't play for money. They were just playing cards to just kill the time. Well, now they've got Christmas bonuses. All of a sudden, all these cabbies who are scratching to eat cat food for a living have stacks of money in front of them. And they're playing for money, just as the professional poker player comes in. And they all tell, you know, Louis tells them he's a professional. So they don't know what the hell they're doing. They should know to avoid this guy. But they don't. They decide to sit down and play with him. So Louis pulls Alex aside, who is really Judd Hirsch, the star of the actual show. And he says, "Look, I want you to play my brother, and you're the best poker player in the place." He's like, "Yeah, but I'm not that good. He's professional." And he's like, no, I think you can beat him. It's all about ego. I think you can beat him, blah, blah, blah." And he's like, "Well, what do you want to play for?" And he says, "Well, you know, I'm going to," and it ends up being he bankrolls Alex for $3,000. And they play each other for $3,000, and it's no limit. He actually says it's no limit, but they play stud. So here's what really ticked me off, okay? It was a lot of the stupid Hollywood stuff. You know, hey, you know, I call and raise you, and guys raising like a dollar more when they made a bet of 50, or, you know. So it was a bunch of crap, and they were playing heads up. But here was the part that really ticked me off. It gets to the end. And it reminds me of that movie Shade, which, by the way, has been on Showtime for a while, too, which is, oh, my God, it's so ripped off Cincinnati Kid. It's not even funny. It was so bad. But there was a part where, like, in Shade where, you know, Sylvester Stallone says, you know, I could buy the pot because you don't have any more money. So all I got to do is put more money in, and you can't, you know. And, you know, they don't even understand the premise of all in. But so, yeah, the same thing happens here. The brother goes, "I'm all in," and he bets all of his money. And Alex says, "I can't cover that." So then Louis goes into the cage, and he gets the company receipts. And he comes out with the money, and he's like, "All right, I'm going to call your bet, and now I'm going to raise you $400. And then the brother's like, "Louis, I don't got $400. You know, now the pot at this point, Scott, is probably $5,000. Okay, $5,000. And it went from like, I'll bet 200, 200, 500, 500, raise, raise, raise. And they're going back and forth with the raises. It was like 8 raises, okay? So Louis's like, "All right, well, you can give me your watch, blah, blah, blah." And the brother's still short. So Louis comes up with this long list of things that he wants the brother to do for the mother that he takes her out. He equates it to money. So he's like, "All right, I think, you know, a night out, one of those glitzy, glammy shows, and dinner every single night, and you got to tell her you love her every day." You know, so he's listing all these things to make it equal $200. Finally, they get to the call, and he's like, "All right, I'm going to do all that stuff. I call. I got aces up," and he's got aces over jacks. And then Alex's board is like, the door card was a 6, so it was like 6-5-9-6. And then whatever his down card was going to be. And Alex says, "I got 3 sixes. And he turns over his whole card to show another 6 and like a rag or something. And so here's where Hollywood really drops the ball. Do you really think that a professional poker player would not only lose all of his money and then go all in when Alex can't possibly fold, but then call all this crap he has to do with his mother with aces up? I mean, please, okay, you don't understand the rules of poker, you don't understand the whole I call and see you don't understand any of that crap, but did you really think a guy who makes a living at poker, who knows the door card was a 6 and Alex played the hand and then paired his door card, couldn't possibly have trips? Also, he's an amateur, and so you would know that he wouldn't risk the company's receipts and his own job and like $5,000 on a pair of 6s or 6s up. And it got to me so much that I almost canceled the season pass a taxi.
Oh, no, not the season pass a taxi.
Well, don't you think that there's got to be someone on that set who's saying, "Guys, we got to at least give him trip aces to lose to a full house or something." Right?
I would totally agree. Though, when was taxi made? Like the 1940s or something?
70s.
It's been a long time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So, the most impressive thing of this story is that they had a professional poker player on the show in the 70s. I mean, who was that? That's back when Doyle was still lying about being a poker player,
yes,
wasn't
yes.
it?
That's exactly right. That's right when he was winning the world championship, probably.
So, I mean, I think that's pretty amazing that there was even on there. So, I guess my next question is, you know, how many people on the set actually had played poker at that point? You know, these days, it seems far more commonplace. So maybe it's not as much of a stretch as you're saying. But yeah, I think you're right. I think, you know, there's got to be the grip or the best boy or somebody has to go, whoa, hey, man, that's not the game I play.
I mean, this guy's got to tout his mother all around, tow her or whatever, all around Vegas now, taking her to shows and feeding her every night with aces up? Come on, the guy would not have kept raising them. There's just no way.
And I guess the other thing too is we're equally laughing at the James Bond that it's royal flush over King High royal flush. It's equally as crazy that. So I guess I give him credit for making it a little bit more realistic.
I gotta tell you, you need to watch the show though. It was pretty damn funny, and now the quality of the show is so poor. It's such an old reel that they're running, that the audio is bad and the sets are, just atrocious and stuff. But the writing is there and the characters are just fantastic. So if you've never watched it, like you said, then if you ever get a chance, you should tape it up because it's pretty funny. But that, poker aside.
Yeah, of course. Well, Taxi, I believe, if I'm correct, was filmed in Chicago, right?
No, New York.
No? Darn.
It was a major city, though, so you're almost, you almost have your segue down.
I was trying to find a way to make a segue there, but no, you always let the facts get in the way of my good stories. All right, but we know what is based in Chicago is the Windy City Poker Championship, and we've enjoyed over the years working with Kirk Fowler, does the TV for it as the executive producer, and of course Chicago Joe always loves being there, and Chicago Jason's there, and Chicago
Mike
Shaquille, and Chicago, whoever, whatever your name is there, your name is Chicago there.
Why isn't Chicago Kirk? That I can't understand that.
That is a fascinating question.
How is it not Chicago Kirk?
Maybe it's from the suburbs.
And how is it not Captain Kirk? I mean, how does this guy not have a nickname?
Maybe he lives in Fowler. Maybe it's Fowler Kirk. We just got to transpose some stuff. But every time this year, not only is it Christmas, but it's also the Windy City Poker Championship, and I wanted to give a special shout out to it this year because they're going to be kicking off on December 15th with the Anti-Up Magazine Chicago Poker Championship.
Awesome!
And the winner of that event will get the option of an Anti-Up Poker Cruise Package if the prize pool exceeds $13,000, and it sounds like it's headed that way. So for those of you looking for a way to get on board one of our great cruises next year, here is an opportunity for you. They have five other tournaments planned, including the televised main event, which is always a good time, televised high rollers event that I think Chad Brown and Rick Raheem are committed to.
Oh, cool.
And Joker's Wild Rebuy Tournament, where they add a Joker to the deck. Can only imagine the action in that.
Oh, my God.
And a heads-up tournament as well, too. All these, of course, benefit charity and will be held in Countryside, Illinois, right outside the city limits. And for more information, you can give Kirk a call at 708-935-2861.
They better have some serious verbiage planned for that Joker's Wild event. I mean, they really better explain exactly what you can do with that Joker and... is it a draw game, I hope? Because if it's a flop game and the Joker's on the board, I mean, what? Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that.
So it better be like a draw game or a stud game.
It'd be great
game.
If it's on the board and everybody's got a set.
Or whatever, but I mean, if you got a pair, you got a set, and then you play it your way, he plays it his way, so it's going to have to be a stud or draw or something. Otherwise, they're going to have some serious rules.
So I wonder if a six-card royal flush is the best hand, then.
Six-card royal flush. Oh, my God. But really, I mean, I think I've talked about it on the show a little bit. A couple of times when my stepson came down over Christmas break, we like to play cards together late into the night, and we played Omaha 8 with a Joker, and you didn't have to declare how you were using a Joker if it was on the board until you showed your hand. And it was pretty funny. In other words, like, until the other person, when one person showed their hand, then you can change your, So it was pretty sick. We literally took like 15 minutes each hand to figure out how we lost or won. So you better have some serious verbiage there, Kirk.
I love all the interesting tournaments and stuff that they do up there.
Yes,
and
yes.
A couple of good times. Best way to get on television anywhere, I think, at these events. They're all affordable. So check that out. And tell Joe and Jason and Kirk and said Annie Upset hi. And we'll see you on the cruise, hopefully.
Yes. Okay, some more rules. When you call the hotline, you should really tell us who you are. It's kind of hard to play your clip if we don't know who you are. We still do it, but if you're going to want the swag, you're going to have to eventually come clean and tell us who you are. This call came in, and it's something to do with restealing, so let's hear it.
Hey, guys. I wanted to ask you a question referring to maniacs at the table. I had a situation where a 150 stack blind raises to 15, which I think is absolutely terrible, at a 1-2 game. And then a very tight player with about the same stack hems and haws and flat calls. It folds to me in middle position, and I have ace-8 suited, and I decide I can make a steal attempt here and go to 75, sitting on about 500. The only problem is there's two players behind me with have me covered. Am I giving away way too much in this play? And do you like it as far as a re-steal attempt against a blind raise?
I'm not sure that he wanted me to answer this. I don't think I've ever made a $75 re-steal attempt in my life.
Well, I love the re-steal he did. And I don't even care what his two cards are. It really has nothing to do with it. I mean, I guess if someone calls and needs to hit his hand, that's one thing. But really, it's a re-steal. He's sort of squeezing. And I don't care about the blinds. They're blinds. I mean, the odds of the blinds waking up with something, you know, or whatever, the people behind him. I mean, so I'm not really worried about people behind him. I like the re-steal. I think it's a move that a lot of people don't incorporate in their game, and maybe even me included. I don't think I re-steal enough, and I think you should. I think that those are hands that, you know, you feel like there's dead money out there, and I like that he said $15 raise was terrible, which yeah. I always agreed with, even though it's pretty much the norm between 10 and 15 when you're playing that limit, but yeah. I totally agree with that. I don't know why we can't just make it 6 or 8 and be happy with that, but they always want to make it too much, and you know, it's weird how we lose our inhibitions when we're playing live, yet when we're online. Yeah. If somebody made it $15 online, I would literally just sign off right there. But I like the re-steal attempt. I don't disagree with that at all.
Well, what about the players they act behind? The bigger deal, I think, was the fact that they both have bigger stacks than we do. So are we at all worried about someone re-stealing?
No, I mean, again, that's the one thing you have to be prepared for when you make a re-steal, is that there could be someone to come over the top of you who could felt you. And if that's the case, you have to know that the amount of money you're making it, you may lose. But you can't play like that. You can't play like, ooh, what monster under the bed is going to hit me if I try to make a move here? It seems like it's the right play to him, and I don't mind it. I mean, I don't really think about that. I think about calling their bets, knowing I can go broke, but I have to play my game too. I don't think I'm too worried about the bigger stacks behind me, because even if they did re-raise, then I know, all right, well, if they made it 300 to go, that's almost my whole stack. I can get out of the way here, because I'm not going to do it with ace eight or whatever. So yeah. I don't really worry too much about the stacks behind me in that instance.
Excellent. All right, well, Unknown Comic, you have won a great thing from our swag shelf, a t-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the AntiUp store at antiupstore.com. Email us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com and include your phone number, because we have caller ID. That's the only way we're going to know it's you. We don't have the 24, voice analysis at the FBI to make sure you're the same voice. So
don't forget, the hotline is 813-448-1120. And I guess for the PMS Pokerware shirt, we could say, don't play poker with a paper bag on your head.
That'd be pretty awesome, though.
Maybe, that would be cool.
Maybe we'll get Kirk next year for the Windy City to do a hat tournament. Everybody has to have some sort of headwear.
I would love it if we all had to wear bags over our heads, though, and then you wouldn't know who you were playing against. So yeah, all that stuff, all that history goes out the door, you know.
And then imagine you're in the blind, then you'd be double blind at that point.
Double blind. Well, you can cut little holes out. I mean, I don't expect you to guess at what you got.
All right, well, our mailbag this week comes from Don from Michigan, and he sent this in actually a while back, and we're just finally getting on the show. But it was right after we interviewed Vanessa Selps.
Yes.
And he said he found the multi-table tournament discussion interesting. Something she said that stuck with me was being patient in multi-table tournaments, while balancing the obvious need to accumulate chips to stay ahead of the escalating blinds. I'm sometimes hesitant to take a borderline risk early, as I think there may be a better spot in the future. Could be situations or advice on the best way to balance those challenges that we face in multi-table tournaments?
Well, one of the things that struck me from this letter was that I don't know the stakes that Don plays But given that he's listening to our show, I would assume that they're not large buy-in tournaments. And most smaller buy-in tournaments, you don't have a lot of chips to have the type of patience that she was outlining. You know, she was, I'm pretty sure that she was talking about the Mohegan Sun NAPT events, which were like $5,000, and then it might even been, she might even been talking too about another one, which was even more than that buy-in. And you know, they're going to give you like 10,000 to 30,000 chips and 2-hour blinds and things like that. So, you know, for her to say that she was being patient and still trying to accumulate chips is a totally different thing than, hey, the blinds went up 5 minutes ago, now they're going up again in 5 more minutes. You know, it's a totally different way to try to be patient. The one thing that I would advise, I guess, is to really understand the tight players at your table. And when they're in the blinds, that's when you make your move to try to steal, especially if you're the first one in the pot. That's how you'll keep up with staying at the average without taking that risk that he mentions. It doesn't have to be this sort of borderline risk. It could just be standard 3x raising that if you could come over the top, or, you know, it doesn't have to be your cards now. You're playing the player there. That's the only thing I can recommend, because I really don't know what types of, you know, levels he's playing as far as blind structure and things like that and buy-ins. But if he was playing her types of buy-ins, then I think you could just be patient, because you have so much time between when they go up and when you really have to make a move.
Yeah, very true. I guess what I'll add to it is one of the more interesting things that I learned from Don Baruch, who used to write a column for us and has a World Series bracelet, and did some training with us for a while. And talking to him one day, and he's like, you know, hey, at the beginning of the tournament, I'm going to play a lot of speculative hands. You know, I think he said even like 6-4, but that's probably not right. But his point was, he's like, at the beginning of the tournament, people were a little hesitant to get involved, which I think is what Don here from Michigan is talking about.
Right.
You know, hey, I, it's early. I'm going to get better situations in the future. Why should I commit here? And Don Baruch takes advantage of that by pushing those edges, because he knows it's more likely that he's going to get people to fold and he's going to accumulate those chips early on. And the real genius, I think, in that is that you're getting it on the cheap.
Yeah. Yep.
At the beginning of the tournament, so the blinds are relatively low, your chip stack is relatively high, and so you're doing that when it's cheaper. And then the best part is if you're really successful at changing gears, which you need to do, and knowing what the right time to do it, you know, you're setting your players up to fall later on in the tournament when the blinds get bigger and stuff, and you've changed gears and I don't say tightened up, but probably tightened up, and are playing more premium hands. And so I think it works in a lot of ways. I mean, I've tried it in a couple of tournaments. I can't say I'm perfecting it like Don did, but that was an eye-opener to me, that because I was one of those players at the beginning of the tournament that just said, you know, hey, it's early. I don't need to get involved in this. So I'll have a better shot later on, and I think there are players that take advantage of that.
Yeah, I like when he mentions borderline risk. I like to call it calculated risk, and make sure that, you know, the raises that I make or the calls that I make are things that, you know, are, when they're easy decisions for you, when you're in position, or when it's, you know, you're in a blind and you're just speculating with a suited ace or something, you know, and you know you can get away from the hand. Those are calculated risks to me. I wouldn't do anything like a 4-bet or a 3-bet with just because you think that it's, you know, you need to get some chips or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
with no hands.
No.
Yeah, so always be calculated what you're doing. And like Scott said, you know, there's no reason not to speculate early on, because you're not really risking too many chips and the blinds are so small. But if the blinds are going quickly, then, you know, I wouldn't recommend being too patient that it cripples you and you go like Broomcorn's uncle. You weren't expecting that, were you?
No, nice reference there. Right.
Thank you.
All right, well, Don, you already have some swag, but everybody else that sends us a mailbag question to podcast@antiupmagazine.com, we'll be happy to give you something great, like a download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro, a hand history analysis program for single or mixed games from element26.net.
Floor! It's time to call the floor. This one comes in from Mike Myers. Cue the Halloween music.
Yeah, we do that every time he's on the show.
I know, I'm sorry. Do we do that every time? Do we say Halloween every time?
Well, I mean, we should. I'm not saying we shouldn't.
Okay. Oh, okay.
You know, if we didn't, then our new listeners would be like, oh, my gosh, how did they miss that softball there?
I know. Or we could do some sort of gold member thing, but, you know. Okay, so he says, I was playing in a 1-2 no-limit hold'em game in California. Check the flop with the intent to check raise. Player bets 40. Another remaining player goes all in for 52. It gets back to me, and I say, all in. The dealer says, you can only call the $52. I say, that is just not true. Please call the floor. You cannot deprive me of my chance to check raise.
The floor, I think that's in the Constitution, isn't it?
I think it's in the Bill of Rights.
It's the 11th Amendment. Yeah.
No, the Bill of Rights is the first 10, so now you made it outside the Bill of Rights. You're killing my joke. All right, so the floor sides with the dealer and says that he couldn't raise. I say, what? Later on, I run into another floor, and I tell him the story, and he says, that was a bad call. You should have asked for another floor person. What? He says, the original floor call was the original floor's call correct? And is it really protocol to ask another floor if you don't like one floor's call? Can you even do that? And if you cannot, and you are sure the call is a bad one, is there any recourse?
I love this question.
Because, it is a good question.
Very interesting, and I like Jody's answer. And here's what Jody had to say. He said, floor people make incorrect calls sometimes. Sometimes they don't understand the situation, and sometimes they simply don't know the correct call. I agree that was a bad call, but I disagree about getting a second decision. It's tough to watch someone blow a floor call and sit still, but it would be counterproductive to allow players to keep asking for different floor decisions on their situation until they hear the answer they want. I certainly wouldn't want to play in a room that allowed that. Think about how you'd feel if a correct decision was made in your favor and then overturned as a result of a re-decision. In a bigger room, you could tell the floor person you think they may be incorrect and ask to speak with the shift manager on duty. Otherwise, just deal with the bad call and ask the room manager to speak with the floor person who made the bad call and make sure it doesn't happen again.
Hmm. I don't know. I think that if I knew that I was right, I might have to do something.
You're going to turn the table over?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what I would do. But
mad as hell, and I'm not taking it anymore.
I mean, this is an interesting thing, because when you and I were in a poker room once locally, and I was in the tournament, and it was all in. I wanted to go all in, and the guy's like, you can't go all in because there was only four raises. And it's already four raises or whatever. And I'm like, we're playing no limit. I could do whatever I want. And he said, no, the legislation said it's capped at four bets. And I'm like, no, you need to reread that. So they ended up, we kept having a conversation that the floor person ultimately called the poker room manager over so that we got a person higher than a floor. And it wasn't like a shouting match or anything. We were just discussing it. And everyone at the table was agreeing with me. And the dealer and the floor were agreeing with themselves. So it was a thing. If they finally got the manager over him, and the manager promised to look into it. And then sure enough, after the tournament, when we were all done, the next day or whatever, next week, they changed their rule and said you could do it. So I was stuck in the, you know, I couldn't do it. But I don't know if I was, especially if I was playing cash, and I knew I had, like, the nuts, and I want to bet more, get more money from this other guy, and you're not going to let me? Why is it that I can't? It's $52 to me. I could do whatever I want. It's not like it's a min raise. You know what I mean? It's not like it's not a legitimate raise to me. I'm still cold at $52. I should be able to bet whatever I want in front of me. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, I mean, I guess Jody's answer is obviously calculated as being a floor. And I like the fact that he's like, you know, hey, can you imagine the scenario? Hey, I appeal.
Yeah.
They bring over one guy. All right, I appeal that. And then you keep... You know, every floor there gets a chance to chime in, and that's certainly not productive. But I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, hey, I think that decision was wrong. Can I get a second opinion? I mean, you never know. They might say, oh, hey, great, and call somebody over.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's what they should do, but, you know, hey, it all depends on the stakes you're playing, too. I mean, it's a big, massive pot. You're right. I don't want to sit there and accept a decision that I know is wrong because I happen to get the one floored person on duty who's, you know, distracted or having a bad day or doesn't know the rules. It's not fair.
Yeah, I mean, so, that's the whole point of playing in a legal, you know, regulated environment, is so that there are rules that are stated that are correct. And if you know the rules, that's the other thing too about having the rules posted somewhere or having a book somewhere that they follow that you can look it up before it's over. If you said to the guy on the floor, look, I don't want you to get another floor but I know that this poker room follows this book of rules. Can you please go get the book of rules and look it up before you decide, because I'm really pretty sure that you're not getting this correct for me, and I don't want this other guy to be mad at me because I'm taking money out of his pocket or whatever, but you really need to look it up for me. Then that's something else, too, that it should be considered if that's something that's available in their room.
Absolutely.
But real good letter. And I often wonder when something like that would happen, what would happen. And it still looks like it's still up to, you know, the each individual room to decide how they'll take care of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, remember, you can email your call to the floor questions to podcasts@anyupmagazine.com or post them on our forum at anyupmagazine.com/forum. And a couple more housekeeping items. Remember, it's still holiday season. So if you haven't bought me a gift yet, you can find great things that I would love at the Antiup store at antiupstore.com. And don't forget our cruise schedule, because we're not going to let you forget it, because we're going to keep reminding you of it all year long. But our next one officially is March 17th out of Tampa next year, although I guess I could still get you on the December one in a week. Yeah. You're really desperate to go.
Yeah.
And don't forget August 27th out of Port Canaveral, November 10th out of Baltimore. We already have a booking for the Baltimore already.
It's a year away and we have a booking. That is the greatest thing I've ever heard, I think.
I almost wanted to tell the guy, hey, I'm not trying to talk you out of coming, because I love the fact that you're calling, but you are not a poker player planning that far ahead. But no, that's great. It's good to see that we got enthusiasm for all these cruises next year, and looking forward to them. So remember to go to antiupmagazine.com/cruise and get all the details.
Lots of stuff happening this week on the Antiup News Desk. Let's hear it.
North Carolina Governor Bev Perdue this week signed a gaming compact with the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians to allow them to deal table games and poker with live dealers at its Harrah's Cherokee Casino. The deal, however, still needs to be approved by the state legislature and the Department of Interior.
Yeah, you know, one of the things, too, I noticed on there was that they couldn't have any more than 10% of their employees out of the state to encourage jobs, and I love that. I mean, that's the whole point of doing this, is so that your state flourishes and whatever. So that was a good thing. And still got some ways to go, though, right, Scott?
Yeah, but we'll see how it goes. I mean, the legislature, I think, is wrapping up this week, and then they'll have to call a special session if they can't get it through. And then, of course, the Department of Interior also always has to rubber stamp it. But they've been working on this for a while, so I'd like to see it go through. And interesting you brought up the 10%, too, because it's great that you're trying to create jobs in the state. I'm surely not saying that that's a bad thing. But from a player standpoint, it could be. You know, think about how many professional dealers there are that live in North Carolina.
Yeah.
Because there's no jobs there. I mean, I'm not saying that they're not, they could be qualified, but I mean, there's just no dealing jobs there.
Right.
So, you know, there might be a lot of break-in dealers and trainers for a while. So it's good for the economy, but it also could be a lot of floor calls going on there. And remember to ask for a second one, too, by the way.
Well, the other thing, too, is a lot of times when we're talking to these poker room managers when we travel, you know, we say, what set you apart or whatever. And a lot of them say, you know, that we train all of our dealers ourselves.
Right, yeah.
So this could be a good way for them to, you know, really, you know, set some, if they get somebody really good to train them, you know, to set and make them all uniform and make it all really good. So there's two sides to every coin. Saying he's grown tired of the partisan rancor and of campaigning, U.S. Representative Barney Frank says he'll retire at the end of his current term, which ends with 2012. Frank, a Democrat from Massachusetts, has been arguably online poker's biggest proponent in Congress. That's pretty sad.
Yeah, you like how I got rancor in there?
Yes, yes.
It's a good word, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very big word.
You can use that in Scrabble.
Big word for you.
No, this is terribly sad. I actually had some lunch with some friends this week that aren't poker players, and they were sad to see him retire as well. And I'm like, hey, you're not as sad as I am. I mean, this guy has done everything for us to get online poker approved.
Yep.
And I can't disagree with getting tired with the partisan rancor and campaigning. I mean, that's stuff that's just frustrating for everyone. So, you know, I wish him well and thank him for all of his service. But, you know, if he can't get this online poker passed before he leaves, I'm a little worried about what it means for a future, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Barton's going to have to carry the torch, I guess, for a while.
All right, well, finally, Spider-Man Tobey Maguire is the latest Hollywood celebrity to agree to a settlement in a lawsuit seeking repayment of poker winnings from a convicted Ponzi schemer. Maguire has agreed to pay $80,000 to the bankruptcy trustee for Bradley Ruderman, which is about one-fourth of the amount Ruderman says he lost to the movie star in unlicensed Hollywood home games.
I'm not really sure what to think of this.
It's very convoluted. It took me a while to think through this whole thing and try to figure out what's going on here. But a couple things. One, this guy was a Ponzi schemer. It's not full tilt. You know, I think people out there think I hate the term Ponzi schemer, but I only hate it when it's wrong.
Right.
This guy was scum. So, you know, what they're saying, obviously what they're trying to do is recoup the money that this guy stole from everyone in the Ponzi scheme and return it to those players, or those people, not players, I'm sorry.
Right, right.
Those people. So, you know, what they're saying now is, you know, hey, since you're playing poker, it wasn't in a legal environment, those debts aren't enforceable, and we need all that money that you won back. So, of course, they sue him, and as we always say, you know, sometimes it's just better just to settle than go through the whole legal process, and I think that's what's happening here. Gabe Kaplan was the first one, I think, to settle with this guy for less than Toby, just a weird situation all around.
That's another flag goes up for hosting your own home game.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, that's the takeout for me here is that, you know, hey, we all like to enjoy our home games and, you know, we like to keep ours low stakes and fun. But when you get to the point where you're playing for big money in these unlicensed games, you know, you got to expect this stuff to happen.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of places to play live legal now and more are coming. So, you know, unless you really have to. I don't see a reason to play in these games, and if you do, then you got to expect that, you know, bad things are going to
happen. Yeah, bad things can happen. Well, I have to admit, I'm very excited about our brand new, fresh off the shelves, O'Malley's Move, because it's in my favorite game. So here we go. Here's a 4-8 stud 8 move from O'Malley.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. Ante up, because we're playing some stud. Of the high-low variety, that is. Seven players at our table. We're the youngest by about 97 years, and they all play loose passive. Perfect for us, actually. Our plan is going to be to wait for a hand and value bet these suckers to death. We're playing 4-8, and we're at a seven-handed table. Excuse the redundancy. We look around the table and see the King of Spades, King of Diamonds, Nine of Diamonds, Ace of Spades, Five of Spades, Queen of Clubs. I know it's hard, but try to keep up. And we have the Three of Diamonds showing, and the Ace of Diamonds, Two of Diamonds in the hole. Wow. We're bringing it in, and we've got ourselves a monster. We complete the bet to $2, hoping someone will raise. Oh, did I mention we're short-stacked again with 125? We watch as the King of Spades folds, the King of Diamonds completes our bet to $4, the Nine of Diamonds folds, the Ace of Spades calls, the Five of Spades folds, and the Queen of Clubs calls. This is exactly what we wanted. We raise it to $8 and watch as the rest of the table calls our raise. Is this too good to be true? Well, anyway, the pot is $39, and the King of Diamonds gets the Five of Clubs, the Ace of Spades gets the Queen of Diamonds, the Queen of Clubs gets the Seven of Hearts, and we pick up the Ace of Hearts for a pair of aces. The Ace of Spades Queen of Clubs is first to act, and he leads out into the pot for $4. The Queen of Clubs Seven of Hearts gets out of the way pretty quickly, and it's up to us. Normally we'd raise here to see just how strong our opponent is, but since we're the only player left in this hand with any kind of low draw, we want that third player in for insurance purposes, in case we don't scoop, since we know the bettor doesn't have another ace. Maybe he has four Broadway cards. We simply call, as does the King of Diamonds Five of Clubs. The pot is now at $51. The King of Diamonds Five of Clubs gets the Six of Spades, The Ace of Spades, Queen of Diamonds gets the Eight of Diamonds, and we get the Six of Hearts. We're in pretty good shape here. What's more, the Ace, Queen, Eight checks. This decision is clear. We've got to start building a pot, especially with the limits now going up. We bet $8, and once again, both players just call. Pot is now at an even $75, and sixth comes down like this. The King of Diamonds, Five of Clubs, Six of Spades gets the Four of Hearts. That might be another low draw. The Ace of Spades, Queen of Diamonds, Eight of Diamonds gets the Queen of Spades, and we get the Six of Clubs. Well, that's two pair, but now the Queens lead into us. Are we calling this down, or are we still trying to build a pot?
Today's guest is a licensed mental health counselor and author of the new book, The Mental Game of Poker. Jared Tendler previously did poker coaching at StocksPoker.com and is now a featured coach at DragTheBar.com. He's also an accomplished golfer who does mental coaching for golfers as well. Jared, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Scott. Make me sound like a jack of all trades.
Hey, we all like to have stuff to fall back on.
Exactly.
Chris and I do not have anything to fall back on, so... all right, well, I'm going to start here by saying that when I was a guest on Paul Harris's radio show in October, a random player just walked up at Harris St. Louis to Paul and saw a copy of The Mental Game of Poker on the table and said, "Hey, Paul, that is the best." So that was deeply impressive to me because, you know, when people know somebody's around, they'll usually say something, but the guy was just randomly walking by. Pretty high praise for your book there, sir.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great to get such good feedback. That story was relayed to me actually by the person. He found me on Facebook, so I had heard that before. And, the interconnected world is amazing. I spent 2 years working on the book, so to have this kind of praise has been awesome.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about this book and really what prompted you to write it?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with the second question. I think what prompted me to write it was that I felt like there was a need to take the mental game, poker psychology, a step farther. You know, Schoonmaker and Tommy Angelo, Hilger, guys like that, you know, I think kind of really set the foundation and got more poker players focused on the importance of the mental game. And I liken it in a similar way to golf with Bob Rotella. Those of you who play golf are probably familiar with his books, which were phenomenal. And what I saw was just a need to go deeper into specific issues like tilt. Tilt had been predominantly, looked at as being anything less than playing your best. But there's a lot of different kinds of mental game issues, such as fear, anxiety, focus issues, motivation, confidence issues. But yet poker players were seemingly kind of putting it all under this one umbrella of tilt, which in my book I actually define as being anger, just for the sake of simplicity and being able to organize these problems a little bit better. And for the most part, you know, in my experience, and I've worked with, you know, over 200 poker players in addition to doing a lot of coaching videos, that for the most part, when poker players are talking about tilt, they're talking about anger. And some of these secondary issues kind of get pushed to the side because the anger that they have when losing or, you know, during a bad run or, you know, what some idiot at the table is doing to piss them off. Like, all these things just sort of take such big priority. And so my real goal with the book was to try to really systematize, organize the mental game in a very logical, straightforward, kind of non-jargoned way and give people like a real tool, a resource that they could use on a regular basis to be constantly improving in the exact same way that they would be improving in their actual technique in playing poker.
Excellent. Well, you answered my next question, so I'm going to ad lib here a little bit. There's probably there's certainly a class of players out there that are real receptive to this kind of thinking and training, but there's probably some folks, old school folks out there that don't get this. So, what's kind of your advice to them on why they need to think about the mental side of the game?
Well, I think that the easiest thing is to think about your decision making. Actually going through the process of making a poker decision is your technique. If you're a golfer, your technique is your golf swing. You know, if you're a basketball player, your technique is how you dribble and shoot. But a poker player, their decision-making is their technique. And that process is going to break down for similar reasons than a golfer is going to have their golf swing break down, or a basketball player is their shot is going to break down. And it's oftentimes because of these mental factors. You get distracted, you get pissed off, you feel a little bit too much pressure. So when we're looking to try to become better decision makers and better at executing, you know, in tight spots, in tough games, when you're on the bubble in a big tournament, when you're at the final table, the mental game provides you just another avenue to create an advantage, create an edge where you're going to make better, more consistent decisions. I think in the past, a lot of people have gotten turned off by the mental game, sports psychology, because, you know, historically, psychology has made things out to be about your mom, about, you know, like deep-seated issues, about, you know, and so you're lying down talking about a dream you had about some, you know, some weird stuff. It doesn't have to be that way at all. And there's nothing personal in this book. In fact, I make a very clear distinction. This book is about performance. This is about making quality decisions. And these kind of blips that pop up are predictable. So it can be as simple as hating to make mistakes. It can be as simple as like really wanting to win and feeling so much pressure that you end up making a poor decision. So there are a lot of simple reasons for why your decision making can break down that has nothing to do with your, you know, how you were raised.
Well, you know, you brought up some of the things that people do at the table. What are some of the top like mental lapses that you've seen? And also, you know, how did you go about your research? Did you just sit there and play and watch people? Or did you walk around and watch them? Did you interview people for this?
You know, my research was my work. I mean, I've been coaching poker players for 4 years now. And my research has been responding to people on forums and talking to people, interacting with them, certainly live and online, and really trying to understand what poker players go through. When I came from golf, actually, I should backtrack just a little bit farther. The reason I specialized doing sports psychology, golf psychology in golf was because I was an aspiring professional golfer and played some professional golf. I knew the game so well, so I didn't have to understand what golfers go through because I was that person. I was going through it. So with poker, I really had to study, and I certainly read a lot of books and asked poker players like, you know, what do you need from me? Very simply, you know, how can I help you perform better? And, you know, over 4 years, you know, that was sort of steadily how I gained that expertise. And in some respects, I think it's been good. I've gotten this feedback from other people that somebody like me has come from outside of poker and can kind of look at it with a fresh perspective and say, hey, okay, there are certain ways that people are talking about these issues like tilt that are just not working for a lot of people. And the value in breaking down tilt to being not just about playing less than your best, but actually about anger, and then, you know, opening up the avenue for these other issues has been very helpful for a lot of people.
All right. Well, Chris did ask you what were some of the top mental lapses, so I want to get back to that. But what are some of the easy fixes that players can do to maybe help them at the table too?
Yeah, I think we're talking top mental lapses. Focus is a big one. Sometimes players get distracted by previous hands, you know, especially one that was, you know, perhaps a pretty sick beat. And that doesn't necessarily always have to cause anger. You can just be slightly frustrated or just, you know, kind of wondering if you could have made that decision better. And I think the important thing to do in that regard is to always leave what I'll call like evaluation or analysis to after a session. You obviously want to be making adjustments to, you know, the changing dynamics of the game, making sure that you made proper decisions, but you don't want to go too heavily into that thought, because if you do that, you're kind of separating yourself from the game. You're not going to be able to be focused on the next hand, the action in the exact same way. So you want to just sort of bear down and focus for the duration of your session or the duration of the tournament, and leave the heavy analysis to off the table. Taking down a couple notes can be helpful. Obviously, tilt and anger is a major issue. I don't want to give people the notion that there are simple fixes to some of these more complex problems. With a complex problem, there are many different pieces to the puzzle, and that's what the book is really all about. But you know, a simple tip that has helped many players is just realizing that the mind and the and your thought process is like your mental muscle. Like people who are quote mentally tough and able to deal with difficult circumstances, it's oftentimes because they're able to think through it properly. And so getting, you know, having your anger get the better of you in certain spots means that you're just kind of getting a little bit loose in being controlled and being deliberate about maintaining that control. So being able to recognize when your anger is just a little bit high, taking a couple deep breaths to just slow yourself down, collect yourself, you know, kind of as if, you know, you were about to get into a physical fight and a buddy of yours came up to you and said, hey, like, slow down, stop for a second. And just that like moment of just stopping allows you to collect yourself. The deep breathing is not getting you to relax. This is not kumbaya and, you know, and meditation stuff. It's just about getting you to mentally collect yourself so you can think straight. And you have to force yourself to do that, because right now the reaction, the anger that you're feeling is what's easy. What's harder is to force yourself to slow down. So it's going to take some will and a real concerted effort to do that.
Man, that's great stuff. You know, when the ignorant masses approach me and say stuff like poker is all luck and it's just bingo, and, you know, whether it's in the poker room or even, you know, at Thanksgiving dinner when they're talking to me about poker, I always try to bring up golf and prove my point that it's a skill game like golf is. Now, you were a 3-time All-American in college. What similarities have you found between the mental aspects of these two sports or competitions?
Yeah, it's really pretty striking. I think the issues that golfers go through are really very similar. I mean, golfers have confidence issues. You know, they go through stretches where they're, you know, not even that they're just not getting, you know, good breaks or good variance or good luck, but just they're not, their game's not solid. They're not firing on all cylinders. Like there's always these ups and downs. You know, you play a good round, you play a good hole, you know, and then it seems to be followed up with some poor play. So being able to kind of sustain your confidence through those ups and downs is a big challenge. Certainly golfers have high expectations, you know, and certainly if you've been playing well, your expectations can grow higher. If you've been playing good poker, your expectations can grow higher. And, you know, both golf and poker, because there is so much variance, you know, you just can't set yourself up to expect, you know, things to just keep on rolling very easily, because the games are going to bite you in the ass if you do that. And instead you have to, you know, just sort of stay solid on the process, how you go about making quality golf decisions, poker decisions, you know, and then the execution of that is not always in your hands, and that's a big key. Certainly anxiety under big pressure moments, you know, you get into a big game, big amounts of money, you know, more than you're used to, you know, is oftentimes the equivalent of sometimes even playing for small money on the golf course, you know, but you don't want to look like an a-hole, you know, missing a putt for some big money with a group of guys. So, you know, the pressure can be different, but how you handle that pressure and the skills that are required are very similar to both games.
Well, there are a lot of people in the marketplace doing poker coaching these days, and what I'm drawn to about you is you're actually licensed to counsel people in mental health, where some of these other people aren't. Can you talk about what the difference is in the quality of counseling between someone who's licensed to do it and someone who's just trying to help someone?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it has to do with education and training. I spent 2 years getting a master's degree, you know, after, you know, majoring it in college. And then I spent 3 years getting actually trained, you know, in doing one-on-one therapy with kids and with families and doing, you know, more traditional work. And the value of that was the ability to know what is relevant. So many people think about, you know, an expert knowing what to do, like, you know, teaching you what to do, what to focus on, what to think about. But a lot of times it's also getting you to focus on getting you to not think about all the stuff that's irrelevant. You know, I'm a master at being able to identify what is relevant and what is not. You know, people who don't have that training, there's a mass amount of content out there. I mean, it's, and as you said, there's a lot of people producing it. You know, it's easy to read a blog and hear advice that sounds good. But when you really kind of get down to the nitty-gritty, is it going to stick? You know, is it going to actually solve the problem, or is it just going to provide a Band-Aid? And for the most part, you know, my training is about correcting these poor habits, correcting these poor problems, that, you know, I have a basis of in traditional therapy and traditional psychology, but have found like a niche where I can do that without getting personal. It's just about performance issues, although the process of analyzing the issue, dissecting the problem, and prescribing a solution, you know, is exactly the same. We're just talking about performance-related issues. But, you know, for the most part, people who don't have my level of education or training are going to be looking at or being able to find more solutions to the symptoms. They're not really going to have a robust understanding of the problem, which I talk about in the book, sometimes is as simple as not understanding the learning process. I mean, if you think that spending 5 minutes a day is going to mean that when you're playing in a huge game that you're going to be able to take that work off the table and apply it in that game, you know, you're fooling yourself. It's complete BS, but people have that expectation. They think they should be able to play at their best under any circumstance. But that's a misunderstanding about learning and performance that causes mental game problems like anger because you fail, or confidence problems because you failed. So I guess my long and short answer is it's about having a robust, you know, ability to dissect problems and solve them.
Well, the other thing too is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if someone's unlicensed, there's also a chance of them to do some harm there, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the first day of my master's program, you know, very similar to doctors, we were told the oath, which is your first job is to do no harm. If you do nothing, you know, you do not help a person, that's better than doing harm.
Yeah. And the other question too is, have you ever had, whether golf or poker, you know, a player come to you and say, hey man, Coach X has really screwed me up. I need some help. I need you to, you know, straighten me out or whatever. Has ever had a case where, you know, you've had other coaches, like you're repairing their damage?
In some respects, yeah. And it's not always quite as clear as that, you know, where it's just a person, but I think it's somebody who's been reading books, who's been, you know, kind of working on their own and developed a lot of bad habits. I mean, bad habits can come from coaches doing poor work. They can also come from, you know, just kind of listening too much to general advice.
Wow. Well, Jared, yeah, we really appreciate you joining us and taking this opportunity to let our listeners know where they can buy the book and the other coaching and stuff that you offer and how they can get involved with that.
Yeah. There's the book is available both in soft cover and ebook. The easiest way to find all of the purchase options for the ebook is on my website, mentalgameofpoker.com. You can also buy the soft cover directly from there. The soft cover is available from, you know, all the Amazons. If you get some international listeners, both Amazon.com, the UK, Germany, France, Italy, and Spain, as well as Pro Poker, which does all of 2 Plus 2's books. And then if they want to find out information on my coaching, it's jaredtendlerpoker.com, and there's also information on the book there as well.
Hey, this is AJ Benzing.
This is Justin Bonomo.
This is Downtown Chad Brown.
Hi, this is Clooney Gallen.
This is Daniel Negreanu.
Hey, this is David Singer.
This is Linda Johnson.
Hi, this is Greg Raymer.
Hi, this is Hoyt Corkins.
Hi, this is Cindy Violet.
Hi, this is John D'Agostino.
This is Joe Seabach.
This is Jennifer Harmon.
Yeah, this is Johnny Chan.
This is Cowboy Kenna James.
Hi, this is Mark Safe.
This is Paul Wasikin.
Hi, this is Miami Johnson.
This is Noah Brunson, and you're listening to Annie Up.
Hi, this week's Hand of the Week comes from Wisconsin.
Hey.
Yeah, always like to get a shout out to my good friends up in Wisconsin that freeze up there, so I don't have to cheer on my Packers.
Hey, we're in a bunch of Wisconsin rooms now too.
Yeah, that's right, and this is one of them. And I know they probably sent this in because I have never successfully pronounced this casino's name.
Potawatomi.
There you go. See, I don't have to say it.
Hey, I did it for you. I was trying to save you some embarrassment. You embarrassed yourself enough on the show today.
All right, comes from Richard. Let's see if he's partially unknown. I assume he's from Wisconsin since he's playing there, but I could be wrong. But no, Richard sends us in, and he said this is a hand that his buddy played in a recent multi-table tournament at that casino that Chris just properly pronounced.
We hope. I don't even know if I'm right. I just wanted to help you out.
I think you were. It sounded good.
Yeah.
And, of course, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And he said after this hand, Richard and his buddy get chatting about it in their home game, and he said some interesting differences of opinion came up. So he wanted to send it to us and see what we said.
Okay.
All right, here's the hand, 189 runners. You know, I never hear runners domestically.
You never hear it domestically?
You know, when we have our listeners from Australia or UK or something send it as in, it's always runners. But here in the in the States, it's usually players, isn't it?
Well, yeah, no, I mean, usually is, but I've heard it. I heard it from you, too. I think you say it. I've heard you write it. Or I've read you've written it a few times, I think.
Have you really?
Yeah, I think so.
No, I'm just saying it's rarer.
Yeah, it is rare. I'm not disagreeing with you.
Okay. Yeah.
Not yet.
All right, 189 runners. Hour five of the tournament, 105 runners left. So a couple people got winded there. Make
yeah.
It to the drink station.
Yeah. It must be a race, I guess. That's why they're running.
Blinds increase every 30 minutes. Eight players at the table. Our hero just got moved, so no reads on the players. And, of course, Richard says his buddy can't make reads anyhow, so it doesn't really matter.
Wow, I must know this guy really well.
Rim shot.
Yeah, exactly.
Hero has seven wonderful big blinds in front of him.
Oh, my God, that's a lot for Scott.
Oh, yeah. Hey, we've got 3-4 hours to play here.
Shouldn't you be reading? Shouldn't you be analyzing this?
All right. Richard says the hero has been treading water for quite a while. He feels like he hasn't had much to work with the whole tournament, getting king-king once, but no action. A couple ace-king, ace-queen hands that totally missed. They always miss.
Of course they do.
Other than that, it's been jack-4, 8-2, 9-3, queen-6, etc. He says he stole a couple blinds and pulled off a decent bluff to stay alive, but he's being ground down. I should say so. On behalf of everybody that always criticizes me, why did you let yourself get that short? Third hand at the new table, he picks up jack-jack in middle position under the gun +3. There are two limpers in front of him, a fold, and he secretly salivates that we're picking up a good starting hand.
Wow, so now we even know what's inside this guy's head.
Yes.
Even though it's not really us playing. That's great.
He tries to play it cool and makes it 3.5 big blind to go, half a stack.
Huh.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Why aren't you shoving there? What point is that? To leave yourself 3.5 big blinds to what? Oh, I don't get it. And everyone knows you got a hand there. I don't know what's going on there. I would not 3.5 big blinds when you only have seven. You shove there, right?
Even short stack Ninja Scott is shoving here with jacks.
Thank you. Especially because you're old, that there's limpers though. So
yeah,
but yeah, I'm shoving.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping at that point. I mean, I don't. One, I don't love jacks. Uh-huh. All right, and we had a couple of limpers, but there's some dead money here. That's a great hand.
Yeah,
I'd be happy shoving here and hoping that. Which sounds like crazy to run the gauntlet here and everybody folds and I'll take the blinds, but I think somebody's calling. But I certainly don't want more than one, and you know, 3.5. I mean. I don't think these limpers are going anyway. You're pricing the blinds in, so you're getting a lot of people in. So you've turned this jack-jack hand into a set mining for all your chips.
Yeah.
Essentially, because, I mean, I guess you could fold and hold on 3.5 big blinds, but even that's too crazy for me.
Yeah, no, you're going to be racing a lot of cards here. You don't make it enough. Seven big blinds is a lot to call if you have, you know, if you don't, but if you're in a blinds or if you've limped already, but... 3.5 is a piece of cake, so you need to shove with jacks.
I mean, I guess the point is here trying to you know, sucker some more people in, but you know, as you just said, you don't want to sucker more people in here.
Right.
When you got seven big blinds, you want to... First goal is to pick up blinds without showdown. And second goal is to get heads up with one other guy and double through him. And then it all... Beyond that, then you're just hoping to hit for the fences and get 3 or 4 people in and really chip up.
Yeah.
But I'm not trying to slow play anybody when I got seven big blinds. Get it in.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I'll say, I mean, even seven big blinds may not be big enough to get the limpers out here.
No, that's true. I mean, I guess calling cold, it'll be tough. So all you have are the limpers left. But again, if they're limping, they really want to go to the mat with a hand that they limped with. So... I can't imagine betting 3.5 blinds when I only have 7 left.
All right, the players behind him fold. Both blinds call, though, and the limpers fold.
Holy cow, that's weird.
Very, very odd, isn't it?
That is really
now,
weird.
Of course, we don't know chip stacks, so, I mean, these limpers have a lot of chips and whatever, but it's still kind of mind-boggling that they would fold to a 3.5 raise.
Yeah.
Particularly from a short stack where they know... That I mean, obviously their opponents can put more pressure on them, but this guy is probably going to be a 3.5 big blind flop bet that you can call and see the turn.
Plus, there's
think, right?
Yeah, there's 12. There's at least 12 big blinds in the pot now. All you have to do is call 2.5 blinds to if you're getting 6-1 on your money. I mean, how could you not call if you had a limping? You know, I mean, it's with the other two callers, those limpers really needed a call. That's crazy.
Yeah, I thought the 3.5 big blind raise was going to be the most shocking thing in this hand, but I really do think that the limpers folding is more shocking to me.
Yeah, that's crazy.
All right, so just a little chip update here. The two players in the blinds have at least 10 times the amount of chips that our hero has. Not that I think that really matters too much.
No, not anymore.
We can't rebuy. Flop is 9-5 deuce rainbow. Both blinds check, and our hero, we'll save the drama here, goes all in for his last game.
Okay. Well, that's to be expected.
Yeah. Well, hey, I don't think anything's going as expected.
That's true. That is true. You could have bet half a blind, and then a dealer could have said four.
Yeah.
Then we could have had a call for another four to see if it's okay to bet a half blind, you know.
Dealer, what's the minimum I can bet? Thank you. All right, the small blind calls, and the big blind goes all in over the top.
Now, can he go all in? Because there really wasn't a raise there. I don't, you know, I'm just kidding. All right, so we got a small blind call of 3.5 big blinds.
Yep.
And then we have a big blind player calling, all going all in. Okay.
Yep. Of course, our hero's already in, and that all in gets the small blind to fold.
Very good.
All right, so our big blind is heads up with us. Cards are turned up. Of course, our hero here shows his jack-jack, and the villain tables ace of clubs, six of spades.
Ace of clubs.
Wait a minute. 8-6, and he says clubs. I'm going to say ace and six of clubs.
Ace. Oh, is there an S in there somewhere? So it's like it's suited. Is that what he means by suited?
Yeah, I think that's
okay. All right, so he's got ace six of clubs. And the flop was 9-5 deuce?
9-5 deuce rainbow.
Rainbow. Oh, wow. Wow, he's giving the jack-jack protection. Collusion floor!
All right, well, our little writer goes on to say this is good with only one club on the board. This basically is drawing to hit his overcard. That is three outs twice for about 12% chance. The hero is looking at more than tripling up. The turn is the tray of clubs. The river is a nine of clubs. Villain backdoors the club flush.
Oh, geez.
So now this is, he says, this is the reason, that's not the reason he's sending in the hand. The reason he's sending in is because my buddy was on tilt over this guy, one, calling preflop. And two, going all in on the flop. This is where the chatter among us started. Everyone agreed that it was a horrible play by the big blind, but I disagreed. Am I the only one who is off?
Okay.
Got more points here, but let's chat first.
All right, the first thing, calling pre-flop. Well, the problem is that you didn't shove. So you're giving these guys who have 10 times your chip stack an opportunity to knock you out with any two cards. So... 3.5 big blinds, just a regular raise, and with two limpers, it's not enough anyway. So this guy sees all that money in the pot, and he, with A6 suited, he's going to make a call.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't he make a call? He's in position, and he's got great odds to call. And this is only the first part. I'm not talking about afterward yet. So
yeah.
You know, with 10 times the amount of chips he's got, you can definitely afford it. So if he made it 7x, I don't think he calls with the A6.
See, I might disagree. You're probably right.
Well, you get a better chance of him not calling. How about that?
Well, yeah, but I'm not going to criticize this guy for even calling the 7 with an A6 suited with a decent chip stack and some dead money in there.
Yeah.
Knowing, you know, if everybody else folds like it looks like it would have happened, then he wouldn't have had to put any more money in. You knock a guy out. I'm not saying it's optimal, but at this point, I mean, I guess the point is this guy's upset that he called 3.5 big blinds. I'm going to say that there's at least an outside chance that he would have called even if he shoved. So
yeah.
Not going to criticize him for calling 3.5.
And then his second point was he was mad that he went all in, or he went all in after it was an all in and a call, right? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
I don't disagree with the all in. If he believes that the small blind is weak, he's getting his 3.5 big blinds back now because that's dead money.
Right.
Or, no, I guess it's not dead money because it's just a call. But, well, I mean, I think that he thinks that if he can isolate, he can probably, you know, hit his ace or whatever, and he doesn't want the small blind in there. I think that he must think he's way ahead of us, and that's why he did it, or that he can hit his ace and still win.
Lots of reasons here. I mean, one, you know, why does he want to keep drawing with a hand that's not great right here? I mean, he's got no pair or anything. Why does he want the small blind stick around?
Right.
To get him out, and then I'm up against the blind. So I don't know about going all in. That's kind of funny. But, I don't know. I'm not having any trouble understanding the problem here.
I guess.
And then the other thing too is, from our hero standpoint, why would you not want him to go all in?
Yeah, you want him to,
because shut the small blind out.
Exactly.
That's the last person you have to beat. You're not getting any more money into the pot anyhow.
Exactly. He. That's what I'm saying. Protection. He should have loved that.
I love that when I'm all in and people start raising on the flop and knocking people out, because those are people I can't knock out. I want those people to knock them out.
Exactly.
If I get the last person just to fold his hand by accident, that's awesome. I certainly don't want to go up against this when I already got the small blind's money in there.
All right, so to recap, we don't think it was a mistake calling preflop. We think it was a mistake to not shove with the jacks. And we don't disagree with the guy going over the top of the small blind's call of our all-in, because this way he isolates against you, and he could hit runner-runner like he did, or he could hit a six or an ace that might be good enough to beat whatever it is you thought was good enough to shove with. So I don't necessarily disagree with being pissed off, because obviously you got knocked out of the tournament and had to do it by runner-runner, so that makes it all more bitter.
Right, right.
But I kind of like the guy's move, at least, to get heads up with you and possibly win the hand, because he didn't believe you, it seems like, or his friend, whatever.
Right, this is one of those situations that I really don't like about poker players, and I'm not picking on this poor guy that upset that he got out, but he should have been ecstatic.
Yeah.
When small blind folded and he turned over the cards and knew that he was a massive favorite.
Yeah.
And that this guy helped him make a massive favor. But what you focus on is you got unlucky, variance caught up to you, whatever you want to call it. And the guy goes runner-runner, which is like the worst way to lose his hand. You know, you'd feel like half as bad if an ace came. But, you know, let's be happy about what happened and just not upset about the result of it here. I mean, we played this hand badly, I think, and we ended up getting the best out of it we could and then just got unlucky.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure that he was thinking that the guy missed the flop and should have gotten out of the way, so you go up against a small blind. But you can't expect that. And again, it wasn't that much money. If you put all of your seven big blinds in the start, you might have gotten him out, you know, or you might have gotten someone else to re-raise after you did that, trapping with like 8-8 or something. And then that gets the A6 out. So you never know what would happen if you had gone all in.
All right, yeah, but here's the thing, too. I mean, everybody out there in Antiope Nation, raise your hand here if the player in the big blind said, hey, I've got A6 suited. You want me to raise all in and knock this guy out? Who would not say, please?
Yeah, I know.
Please do that. That would be awesome. Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
You know, this is the total thing we're talking about, results-oriented here. I mean, that was a beautiful situation. I mean, the only reason you wouldn't want him to call the flop, pre-flop and be in his hand at all is because you end up losing the hand.
Yeah.
You want A6 to call pre-flop. You want him to do what he did now, and, you know, he just got unlucky. I mean, just because somebody does the right thing doesn't mean you're going to win. That's why poker sucks sometimes.
Think about it this way, too. He could have gotten a small blind to fold with Ace-9. And then you would have lost because he would have made 3-9s.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why you love this move. You love him doing that to you. It just happened to be that he went runner-runner on you, which is just so bitter to pill to swallow. But, you know, you can't be upset. I mean, you can be upset. It sucks to go out that way. But you know what? You did. It's just like when you're, you know, when people are calling your bets with flush draws. You want them to call with flush draws when you have the best of it. Because ultimately, you're going to win money that way, and they're making mistakes.
Yep.
So...
All right, well, here's what Richard's discussion focused on. He says, as I see it, my buddy made a mistake by not going all in at the start.
Yep.
Check. I can't imagine he would have laid down this hand with just 3.5 big blinds left, even if the flop had an ace, king, or queen. Maybe he would have wanted to, which is all the more reason just to commit to check, and go all in.
Yep.
Totally agree. You heard it here from the short stack ninja. Get it in. So make the other guy have to decide rather than facing the decision yourself on the flop. As it is, he's just building the pot and inviting these players in. Yep. Singing the gospel here.
Yep.
So on to point one, he said, I stated that the big blind had a call preflop. With two limpers, a 3.5 big blind raise, a call from the small blind, and the big blind already being invested, the big blind was getting 4-1 on his money. A6 is suited is a good hand to speculate with, considering it's a small portion of his stack, and he can get away from it easy if the flop is bad for him. Sure, there's a risk with limpers behind him. One of them could have a sandbagging with ace-ace for a check raise, but he was willing to give it a go. Yeah, really. I mean, I'm willing to put three big blinds, or I guess 2.5 extra big blinds, right?
Yeah.
in there, and if he's right, there's a big raise after that. All right, fine.
Yep. And there's no way that these guys are folding for just 2.5 bets. You know, and it's a flop game. You know, just, anything can happen, and they have a ton of money to do it. I totally agree with that.
All right, and then on the point two, he says, after the small blind check called, it really must have looked like a drawing hand, so I could see why the big blind went over the top to shut him out. The extra 3.5 from my buddy just wasn't enough to get rid of him, so it seemed like he just wanted to show down and not let the small blind draw out.
Check. Yep. Exactly.
And even, I don't even think it's that academic. I think he just wanted to get the player out regardless of what he had.
Yeah. Yep.
I'm not worried about the drawing. I'm not really worried what his hand is at that point. I just know he checked. So he's probably weak, and here's an opportunity for me to get him out and not have to commit any more money to the spot.
I'm sure that there's someone that will take the angle that he didn't consider the small blind having a huge hand there, like a set.
Right,
and only
right.
Smooth calling to get all
well,
your
I
money.
Well, I think that's why the all-in seems a little excessive.
Yeah, a little excessive. I mean, you make it 9 times, you know, or something, but...
I mean, really, at this point, all you're trying to do is get the small blind out, so, you know... All in might even be a little too fishy at that point. You might, you know, the small blind's frisky. You might call you, but all right. So our hero goes on to say, "This is not a great line for the villain. I think his pot odds were under his wrist, close to 6-1 from the pot versus squiggly 7-1 to hit. Rough math." He said, "This is a bit of a gamble, but I can defend the guy's play." Yeah, again, he's not trying to win the overall pot necessarily. He's just trying to give him a better shot of winning.
Right.
He says, bottom line, variance was on the villain side, but as for the debate with my buddies, I hold that the big issue was the 3.5 raise by my buddy preflop. He should have just been all in. The villain may have called anyway, but there would have been nowhere for the hero to go with just 3.5 chips left after his raise. He should have been all in to make the other guy think a little bit more. Most of the time, I think a big blind folds there, and my buddy picks up 3.5 blinds in the process.
Yeah, I mean, it could go either way on that. That might be 50-50, but really, you got to give yourself the best chance possible to pick up those blinds and survive another round, and by doing that, 7 and what were you supposed to do with that 3.5 big blinds? You know,
yeah.
I mean, you have to get it in there anyway. So why not get it all in and thin the field?
Yeah, I mean, the real genius there. I mean, is that you know, hey, you're making this guy make a decision. You don't have to make a decision anymore.
Right.
You don't know what he would have done. And again, we're not getting results oriented, but yeah, if you look back at the hand, some people would have folded A6 there, and everybody would have been out. You would have picked up not only just the blinds, but those two lumbers money. That's huge.
Yeah.
When you have 7 big blinds.
Well, you gotta love the fact that we have listeners now sending in hands of their friends to help us meet our quota of hands of the week. So thank you so much for, you know, listening to your buddy and getting him on the show for us. Hopefully he listens too and has some thoughts on it. But
that was
pretty
good. Actually sent us a link to their little home game blog, jackassespokertour.com. And they have Ante up under the must listen category.
Awesome. We are a must listen. I think we are. I want to I was going to say what did we get anything for him, or because is his friend's thing? Does his friend get it?
New. So at the next home game, they'll be able to show their uncut sheet of J Design playing cards, official playing cards of Ante Up.
Very cool.
Remember, you can only win the uncut sheets, and only for another month. The swag will change at the end of the year here, so get your hands of the week and other comments in so you get those uncut sheets. And in the meantime, buy some cards at the Ante Up store at anteupstore.com.
I think he should give all the red suits to his friend, and he should keep the black suits.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know,
like,
cut it up in sort of an ebony and ivory kind of situation there. Hey, I want to thank Jared Tendler for being on the show today. It was great to have him on, and be sure to check out his book. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.